Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
As adults, we wonder, do kids grieve the same as adults? Or some people have the notion that children's grief is less significant somehow, that they'll forget when they grow up, they'll all be fine. But what we don't realize as adults is that we know that children grieve. One, they do grieve differently. They grieve developmentally.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we are delighted to bring you episode 118, Children's Mental Health in 2021, Grief and Loss. Children in 2021. How worried should we be? In June of 2020, the medical journal The Lancet published the results of a national survey of parents with children under the age of 18 to measure changes in health status, insurance status, food security, use of public food assistance programs, child care, and use of healthcare services since the pandemic began. The survey found that a full 27% of parents reported worsening mental health for themselves and 14% reported worsening behavioral health for their children. Indeed, worsening mental health for parents occurred alongside worsening behavioral health for kids in nearly 1 in 10 families, among whom 48% reported loss of regular child care, 16% reported change in insurance status, and 11% reported worsening food security. In particular, school routines are important coping mechanisms for young people with mental health concerns. When schools are closed, they lose an anchor in their lives, which can exacerbate the mental health challenges they already face. But really, you can also say that at this point, we just don't know how much worse off kids will be. The pandemic, if you haven't noticed, is still going on, and the data is still coming in. Some experts intuit that the pandemic could have a generational impact, with effects that can only be seen through long and careful observation. But one statistic suggests in stark terms what we may be up against. Another Lancet study estimates that up to 1.5 million children worldwide have lost at least one primary or secondary caregiver as a result of the pandemic. In other words, 1.5 million children have lost a parent, a custodial grandparent, or a co-residing grandparent during the pandemic. The study highlights orphanhood and grief as an essential part of the story of this pandemic and one we'll be looking at today. In today's episode, we'll be talking to an expert on children's mental health who represents a grantee of the Hogg Foundation. We'll be getting to know Children's Grief Center of El Paso through the eyes of its outstanding executive director, Laura Olague. But before we get to that, I would like to revisit another topic that we've dealt with on the podcast previously, mental health in sports. Apologies if this seems like an abrupt segue. The 2020 Olympics is going on at the time of this recording, and the world is abuzz with the shocking news that the U.S.'s premier female gymnast, Simone Biles, has effectively benched herself, in part due to concerns about her mental health. Now, the situation is more nuanced than the very first headlines suggested. It may only partially be mental health, as commonly understood, that led to Biles' sidelining herself, but rather an affliction more common to otherworldly gymnasts, the so-called twisties. You can think of it as a kind of performance anxiety that affects the kinesthetic awareness and sense of one's body in space, that is so fundamental to a gymnastics routine. Simone Biles came down with a case of the twisties at the worst possible time and felt the need to withdraw not just to protect her mental health, but even her physical safety as well. In any event, as it is both hard to relate to the extreme pressures elite athletes face, as well as easy to forget that they are, after all, human beings just like us, we have taken a look at sports and mental health a number of times on the podcast, and I've included links to some previous episodes in today's show description. But for this episode, I was able to get a hold of our good friend Dr. Ryan Sutton, a previous guest of the podcast and director of the African American Male Research Initiative at the University of Texas at Austin, who's also had much to say about the connection between sports and mental health. Here is him speaking his mind on Simone Biles.
Mental health in athletics is not a new phenomenon or a new issue, but it's impacted athletes and student athletes for a long time now. Unfortunately, for too long, the issue has been ignored, it's been masked, it's been stigmatized to the point that athletes have become purely a source of entertainment for greater society while having their humanity concealed and hidden. So it's really no wonder that the recent actions of women athletes of color like Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles have come under such mixed attention. We've seen people praise them for the strength they've shown in bringing attention to their mental health in a national and international spotlight, as well as heard individuals bash their decisions to prioritize their mental health over entertaining and performing. But overall, I believe their actions have been powerful for three main reasons. The first is it has spurred conversations about not only mental health, but mental health and the athlete. Through these conversations, we have to discuss what is mental health. What is it that individuals like Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka are experiencing that would cause them to pull back from what they love to do and what they've been trained to do for so long? Within these conversations, it must remind us that these individuals, through whom millions of dollars are being generated and entertainment is being provided, are at the end of the day are still human beings. It's really forcing us to humanize individuals that we as a society tend to strip humanity from. The second thing I think their actions have done is it challenges the norms and the dominant narrative about what is acceptable and what is not as acceptable as it pertains to protecting your mental health. Much of the dialogue I'm seeing and reading focuses upon things like, what other job can you just not perform because of mental health? Or, I couldn't just take off from my job because of mental health. At the end of the day, it challenges the status quo that many of us have prescribed to for so long. Maybe we should refocus our discussions from what they can't do or what they shouldn't be able to do to really question what is it that we need to be modeling in our own lives for protecting and promoting a strong and positive mental health for ourselves, our family, our loved ones, and those in our circle. The third thing I think their actions do is drive us to examine our own experiences with mental health, with chronic stress, and with other factors that can impede our day-to-day functioning and our relationships. If this is what it takes for athletes like Naomi and Simone to take care of themselves, we should be asking, what will it take for us to do the same thing?
This is a developing story, but there are signs that attitudes are beginning to shift in a more empathetic direction, with many fans and fellow athletes praising Biles for putting her emotional well-being first. A sign of this is a recent tweet by Simone Biles herself, which I quote, "The outpouring of love and support I have received has made me realize I'm more than my accomplishments and gymnastics, which I never truly believed before." For those of you listening, thank you very much for indulging me on this little side trip. It's just not every day that we have an episode coming out during the Olympic Games. And this is a hot story. Again, our past episodes dealing with mental health in sports can be found in the show notes, so please look for those. Joining us now is Laura Olage, Executive Director of the Children's Grief Center of El Paso. Children's Grief Center is a two-time grantee of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. The center provides bilingual, culturally sensitive, peer-based bereavement and grief support services to children and their families. Over the last 25 years, the Children's Grief Center has reached over 3,500 children and their families. Laura, hi.
Hello. Nice to be here.
We'd love to know a little bit more about you and your background. How did you find your way into this work?
I am a co-founder of the Children's Grief Center. We started the organization in 1995. We did a lot of market research about the need for the service in our community. And after finding out that there was nothing like this that existed in our community, I started this organization with a friend that did the same kind of work. And we have been here in the community for 26 years. She left after about a year, and I have been the executive director for that many years. Our philosophy for the Children's Grief Center is that grief is a normal part of life, and our effort is to normalize grief as much as possible without giving any labels or diagnoses in terms of mental illness, because we don't see grief as a mental illness. We see it as a normal part of life. So our organization, we serve every type of death you can possibly imagine. And when I'm arrogant enough to think I have heard it all, a new child walks in the door with an experience that I often wonder, how do you walk and talk and chew gum at the same time, considering what you've been through? So some of the kinds of kids that we see are, we have about 30% of our kids that have experienced death, whose loved one died from cancer, and about another 30% from an accident. We have kids of homicide. Somebody shot their mostly parents. We have kids of suicide, sometimes kids that have had a mom and a dad who have died by suicide. We had the Walmart shooting here in El Paso in 2018 and served many families from that shooting. And as you might expect, that's a very traumatic type of death. So helping kids through those traumas. So what do we take care of first, the trauma or the grief? Well, we have to address the trauma so that they can feel safe enough to even begin their grief process. So it's many types of deaths that we serve here in our community. For us, most of the kids that come to us have experienced the death of a parent. And of those, most of those are of the dad. Generally, it's more difficult for a man to bring his children in than it is a woman. It seems like stating the obvious, as it is that women are more inclined to want to express and get help for their loss and be able to talk about what's happened to them. And men find it much more challenging to do so. So for that reason, I would say about 60 to 70% of the families that we see, it's been the death of a dad as opposed to the death of a mom.
Your organization existed prior to COVID. So did the Children's Grief Center's prior experience make it any better equipped to deal with COVID? And has there been a growth in demand for your services?
Yeah, yes, it did make us better equipped. But, you know, having have been here for a number of years, we've experienced kids coming to us from, like I said, everything that we can imagine. But yes, having dealt with those families of trauma, as we had the Walmart tragedy in our community, definitely equipped us, helped us be better equipped to what we were anticipating with COVID. With COVID, that just really hit us like a ton of bricks, slammed the whole community, as in all cities in our country, I'm guessing, or most anyway. And initially, we began trying to provide or providing services via Zoom. And I used my cell phone, whatever way we could reach our clients. so that we didn't have to bring them in. But you know, it was really interesting because in January we began serving families in person again. And that was because parents said to us, and kids said to us also, that we really want to come to the center. We want to come there because we want to do this in person. Parents felt like they didn't have the privacy at home with their kids there. They'd walk in the room. They didn't have the privacy to have the conversations they wanted to have. So we began having our services live again in January. Now, the kids that we served that had COVID deaths, you've probably, I don't want to say something that you were already aware of, but you know, when kids experience COVID deaths, it was much more difficult than other situations because, they didn't get to say goodbye to their loved one. You know, dad contracted COVID, but nobody really knew how bad it was. And the person went to the hospital, or dad or mom went to the hospital and never returned. And the parents too struggle with it tremendously. As a mom said last week in group, they called me in the morning and they said, oh, it looks like he's taken a turn for the better. It looks like he's going to pull through this, and he should be able to come home in a day or two. And then in the evening, they'd call me and said, you know, your husband took a turn for the worse, and it looks like he's not going to make it. And to find out that person died. And there was so much guilt also about, was I the one that gave it to him? Even kids feeling guilty that the whole family got sick, and which one of us gave it to dad or to mom? So a tremendous amount of guilt. A piece to that that it made their grief even more complicated, because this is what we would consider a complicated death, complicated grief, was that no funerals. You know, the person, most of these families, their loved one ended up being cremated, whether they wanted that or not, because that's what they were doing at the funeral home. And it took, in some cases, months to get those ashes back. So there was no service waiting for the ashes. This summer, I see the funeral home just packed daily as I drive by, because some of those families are barely having those services. So, and those families that were able to, you know, what was the limit? 10, you know, at our funeral homes. And they said, the kids said, you know, I missed my family being there, or my friends, or I wasn't able to have my extended family. And then you take that even a step further. The funeral's over, everybody goes home, and nobody can come by and give support to the family, compounding their grief even more so. So it has been a challenge all the way around. These kids feel different. They feel like they don't have the support from the community. Going to school online, who do they talk to about what happened to them? You know, they can use their cell phones, but many of them said they felt that lack of support, that in-person, face-to-face support from their friends at school made a big impact on them, and felt that's what a big piece that they were missing. I want to mention also that, you know, our whole focus in this time was COVID and the families that had someone die from COVID, but we had many other kids who had a death, a number of suicides in that time too, that these families were almost embarrassed to say that their loved one didn't die from COVID, because, oh, it wasn't COVID, you know. So they kind of felt a little ostracized, as though their loss wasn't as important. So it's been a very difficult time all the way around. We have had kids that have had multiple family deaths. I have a a couple of teenagers, a young one and an older one, and their mom. And the dad was one of those that, you know, the mom said, well, he should be better. And then dad ended up dying. And a week later, the grandma died. They hadn't even told her that her son had died. And a week later, she had contracted it as well. Grandma died and dad's brother died. Three people died in like within a period of 10 days. So we've had a number of kids that have had, you know, multiple deaths in a family. And again, those that think they were the ones that gave it to him, they have truly beat up on themselves. You know, they just as though they cannot forgive themselves. And I ask often, well, how could you be absolutely sure that you were the one that passed that along? I mean, you said your dad went to the grocery store, he went to put gas in, you know, he had a number of other interactions where that could have happened. But families tend to think that if that person died from COVID, then they were the one that gave it to them and feel very guilty about that. So definitely been a real hardship on our community.
That was a terrific amount of information. Thank you so much for that. Really.
I tend to get long-winded, so stop me.
No, I won't stop you. I won't stop you. That's often the problem with, you know, with people who are just both doing stuff that's really important and also very passionate about that work.
Let me tell you one other thing also is that,
sure.
You know, we as adults, we wonder, do kids grieve the same as adults? Or some people have the notion that children's grief is less significant somehow, that, oh, they'll forget when they grow up, they'll all be fine. But what we don't realize as adults is that we know that children grieve, one, they do grieve differently, they grieve developmentally. So what that means is that say a child experiences a death, a loss when they are 6 years old, well, they really don't comprehend the permanence of that. Their little brain's not quite developed enough to understand that that person isn't coming back. So as they get older in a new developmental place, they have a better understanding. Oh, my dad's not coming back. Before they thought, well, when dad comes back from work, he's going to take me to the park. But when it gets to that older place where they're a little, the brain is a little more developed, they have a better cognitive understanding. Well, they begin to figure out dad isn't coming back. As they get into the next developmental phase, they start having new experiences where that parent would be there. So say for our COVID kids, you know, school's going to start and I'm going to be on the football team. And oh, if my dad had been there, had been here, he would get to go watch me practice and even try out and be on that team. Oh, gosh, I miss my dad. And as they get to be a teenager, you know, the prom would come up and, oh man, I wish my dad were here. He would love taking pictures. And then they get to college, you know, they're going to graduate. That loss comes back to visit them. So they re-experience their loss, that death, at each developmental place in their life. So it seems like this wave of sadness hits them all over again. Many families call us and say, can we come back for a couple of months? This has happened. I remember during COVID, you know, that there were no graduations and families called and said, gosh, we're having such a hard time because, you know, we can't have this celebration with mom or dad, or can we come back for a while? We just need that added support. So, you know, we know that adults have the capacity to be able to deal with that grief if they choose to, but kids struggle so much. And for younger kids, they don't even have the words to be able to describe how they feel. So part of what we do here is to, as William Shakespeare put it, to give their sorrow words, to teach them the words to describe what that feeling is like. You know, sometimes they say, you know, my heart hurts. Imagine being a little kid and describing that your heart hurts. That's pretty profound, I think, what that ache feels like. So we want to help to teach them be able to learn how to express that. And then when they're sitting with a bunch of other kids and the child says, I felt just the way you did, or yeah, that's what happened to me. Nothing is more profound than to me to hear a child, for example, say a child of a suicide say, you know, I thought I was the only one that had somebody die like that. There is a sense of shame and guilt when a parent dies by suicide. And so when they meet another child that's gone through that, they feel like, wow, I'm not the only one that happened to. Because when a parent dies by suicide, for example, there's a sense that that parent didn't love them, or they didn't care about them enough to stick around. So imagine being a kid and trying to process that. Why did they leave? Why did they choose to leave and leave me here? So I must not be lovable. So it's a real tough road for our kids who are grieving multiple types of deaths.
Okay, so on that, you just shared some very meaningful personal details from, you know, from across your recollections of some of those who you have tried to help. So I was just, yeah, I'm just still curious about any personal stories that you might have that either testify to the need or to the impact that you've been able to have on people.
Yeah, well, the impact is the impact is strong. Let me say that. Let me just share a little story. I was counting the years, and 19 years ago, a boy came with his mom, and his cousin was the father figure in his life, and he was a Marine, and he was killed in Iraq, and this little boy came with his mom, and he was having a real hard time, and he was at that point to where he didn't quite understand that death was real, and as time began to progress, of course, that understanding came to be, and he realized, well, his cousin wasn't coming back. So they were with us maybe 3 years. And so they went through our program, and after about 3 years, they left. And our phone rang about 2 weeks ago, and it was a young man. And he says, as soon as he said his name, I remembered who he was. And he says, I don't know if you remember me, but when I was 5, I came to the center. And he said, I'm about to graduate with my degree in psychology, and I'm wondering if I could possibly come back and volunteer and help. So what better testimony is there to serving our community than to know that he said, I would like to be able to help someone the way I was helped. So in my time, I've had maybe 4 or 5 kids that have been through our program that have come back as volunteers. For him, it was 17 years, 13 years, you know, and come back. Right now, I have a young lady, she's 19. She was here when she was 9, and her father had been murdered in Juarez. And she went through our program. And as she started to get older, she told her mother, when I get old enough, as soon as I turn 18, because I have to be at least 18, I want to come back and give back the way I was helped. I hear kids that have left that have said, I've decided that I want to be a psychologist or a therapist, a counseling therapist, so that I can help grieving kids too. So to me, that's testimony that our service does work. You know, we provide services in our schools. We've taken our program to, we call it our school grief support project. And we've taken our program into the schools. And what we do is we train 8 to 10 school counselors. We pick a feeder pattern. So if you're not familiar with that, with what that is say there's one main high school and all the elementary and middle schools that feed into that school. So it's a total of about 7 or 8 schools. Counselors identify the kids that have had a death, and we send them a notice. Counselors call and invite them to participate. You know, they might say something like, we noticed that your child is distracted, and he mentioned that somebody died in the family, and we have this program that we're going to be offering in conjunction with the Children's Grief Center. Would you and your family like to participate? So here are the benefits that what we're looking to try to accomplish. And one is we want the child to better be able to understand what happened and talk with the parent about what happened, but what the impact that it ultimately has on school and where the child is that their focus has wandered and waned, and so they're not concentrating on what the teacher's talking about. So their grades have dropped consequently. There's a higher absenteeism. There's more behavioral issues. For teenagers, they're just not interested. You know, I really don't care if I fail. During COVID, they just weren't getting out of bed to sit in front of the computer screen because they just didn't give a darn. So we're trying to make it to where there's a place where you can come and your family can participate, your immediate family, and we'll all be on the same page and be able to talk through this process and of what's happened to you. So we're helping the child and the extended children in this family. We're helping the adult or adults, the mother or father, when there's sometimes two, and help them with this process through grief. So when we end up and we evaluate, what did this look like? Did we have any success? And so the kinds of things that we hear back are that, you know, I'm better able to communicate with my mom and tell her how I'm feeling, or we can talk about my dad now before I was afraid to upset her, or now that I've talked about it, I can focus better on my studies. I'm not so distracted, or I want to be at school again. I don't want to just stay home or get hanging around the wrong crowd because I didn't care what happened to me. So we have found a great deal of success. A lot of times families say, well, I can't get to where you are. But when we bring our program into the schools, you know, there's a method to my madness in involving school counselors. Before, we took our team and volunteers from the center out there, but I began to realize we didn't have the investment from the school personnel as we would have if we involved them. So as we train them, the way I sell it to them is to say, when you finish with this project with us, you're going to better be able to help the kids in your school. Because they all say, I feel inept to help grieving children in our schools. You know, I'm a school counselor. Grief isn't my specialty. But once they participate and we guide them, you know, we have one of our staff or volunteer with them, then they begin to understand what it is that the kids need, and they are even more helpful to them. them. So it ends up being a win-win. And we hear from the administration, from the top down, the kids, the parents, when we're on the last day or two, the parents say, can we keep doing this for a few more weeks? Or I'd like to continue. So they're all invited to attend at the center if they choose. But they do appreciate what we've been able to take out to them and the service we've been able to offer.
Okay. Yeah, that is exactly the kind of, you know, fleshed out detail about the impact of what the Children's Grief Center is doing. I was sure that you'd be able to provide for us. Thanks so much for that.
Well, I want to say thank you for the opportunity because
you're welcome.
You're reaching out to a small organization and a community that's not in Austin, but that the Hogg Foundation supports. So without the support of the Hogg Foundation, a lot of this we wouldn't be able to do because we just wouldn't have the resources. So it's been very important to us for them to recognize the work we do and partner with us and better serving our community.
Sure. What are consistently some of the biggest challenges in doing this kind of work?
You know, over my years of experience, one of the biggest challenges, I was thinking about this earlier in the day, that we see is that we want to think that because families initially come here, that they want to do this as badly as we want them to. We want them to succeed. But sometimes families have other things going on. And sometimes they have secrets that they don't want known. And God forbid they should bring their kid and the kid tell that secret, whatever that may be. So, and they don't return. And volunteers will say to me, Laura, did you all call them and remind them? Yes, we did. Well, why didn't they come back? I don't know that reason. Sometimes families just aren't ready or they're not in a place where they can do this work yet because it is work on their part as well. So I think that's a frustration that we all have, that we'd like families to come and work through this and get better, but they don't always, follow through. So I think that's a frustration that we have, but that's not something that we can change. They have to be in a place where they want to do this and they want to get their kids the help. That's definitely a big frustration. Another for us is being a small organization. You know, large organizations have plenty of dollars to market and advertise and, get the word out. We're a small organization. We go through all the free ways we can advertise and market, a lot of our service ends up being word of mouth over the years. You know, my brother came there 10 years ago or however many years ago. I had a client once that she was with us almost 23, 24 years ago. And for about 10 years, I used to receive people that would come and I always ask, how did you hear about us? And they would say, there's this lady at the courthouse. And she said, she works in records and deaths and certificates. And she said that I should come here. Well, I couldn't identify who it was for the longest time. And then I learned that it was a lady that had been with us and her daughter had died by suicide. Well, later she took a job at the courthouse and worked in records. And when someone would come to get a death certificate, she would ask them, did they have kids? And if they said yes, she said, have you ever heard of the Children's Grief Center? And she would tell them her story. I bet we had 15, 20 families just from the word of mouth of that lady who worked in records. So a small organization struggles more to get that marketing message out. I wish that wasn't as much of a challenge as it is, but it is what it is.
So I would love to hear more about your two grants with the Hogg Foundation, I think both of which have to do with kids in schools. If you could just tell our listeners a little bit about what you've been trying to accomplish there.
Okay. We're trying to bring a better state of emotional wellness to kids is what we're trying to accomplish with our project of kids in schools. And with the grant of the Hogg Foundation, we had many COVID families also that came to the center that, you know, after you've had someone in the hospital and all these hospital expenses, you know, where do we go? This is such an expensive thing to try to treat. And we, our center does charge us a small fee, but they couldn't even pay that. So the Hogg Foundation helped us provide service for families, or to be able to say, we can offer you services at no cost for 4 months. I think we have the misconception that because you offer or you are a nonprofit organization, that there is no cost involved. But even small not-for-profits, you know, have to keep the doors open. We have to pay rent and salaries and whatever to maintain the service. So we do have to charge a small fee. But the Hogg Foundation helped us be able to provide service to COVID families. So the families that continue to come, we are able to say we can provide you service for 4 months, and then the next ones that come in. So that's been a good thing. They're enabling us to take our school grief support project back out this fall. Beginning in September, we will take it out to one of our districts, again, to improve the emotional wellness of grieving children and their surviving parents and siblings. So it's not one child receiving service. Sometimes it's four kids, a parent, two parents, a number of family members that are receiving our service. And it's interesting to see when we go out to the districts, you know, when you're part of a community, all your friends that work in that community hear about what you're doing. So counselors from other areas of our community talk to their friends who are involved in this, and they start calling the center saying, when are you bringing this to our district? And can I get involved? I want to be part of the team. I want to learn how to do this. So we're educating also our large pool of school counselors. You know, another part of another hat that I wear is professional education. And I teach workshops to school counselors, diagnosticians, nurses, you name it. It runs the gamut. And so we anticipate educating 400 counselors in the next coming school year. So, you know, we're trying to create an awareness of becoming, and I think it's a new term that's being used in this field, of becoming grief informed, learning about more about grief and loss, and you know, take our head out of the sand a little bit and learning about what we can do to help kids in our community, be it in the school or wherever we are. Maybe, you know, when I train counselors in a workshop setting, I always say, you know, this, I want to give you information to help your kids, but we are humans too, and we experience losses, and sometimes we can't even help ourselves. So what I share today is to help you so that should you have this experience, you have a better understanding and perhaps are better able to cope and help your family cope. And isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? So, thanks to the Hogg Foundation, that's what we will be doing.
My last question. So what do you envision for your organization for the future? And what new milestones are you, you know, hoping to achieve, or just, you know, to kind of ensure the future prosperity of the whole enterprise?
It just seems like in the last year, you know, we've spent so many years trying to become be aware of who we are and the service we offer, because we realize there's such a need for our service. So what we want to be able to do again is, you know, add more staff, add more volunteers. We're a volunteer basis organization. The people that we draw are graduate students, for example, working on graduate counseling degrees, or psychology students, and we have been so blessed to be able to attract that market, if you will. But a lot of community volunteers just want to help kids. So we want to be able to train more volunteers, expand our program, be able to offer more nights so that we can serve the community even further. You know, I don't have I'm not looking to build a $10 million building. I just want to be able to know that we can further serve our community. That may sound simplistic, but that's my goal.
Okay, and to our listeners, if you want to know more about the Children's Grief Center of El Paso and its wonderful work, please visit their website, cgcelpaso.org,
and yes,
do whatever you can to give them support, because there aren't many organizations like it, let alone with its, you know, particular focus on cultural competency and in a very, distinct and unique region of our country, and particularly one that has been as hard hit as the El Paso area has been by COVID. So we, everyone should be in fact grateful that there's an organization kind of anchoring the cause in this part of our state. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it. Our listeners appreciate it. And good luck with everything.
Thank you. And thank you for helping us get the word out. Thank you.
Children's mental health has been an abiding concern for the Hogg Foundation. And this has never been more true than during the pandemic. For episode 98, Dr. Nakia Scott, a child and adolescent psychiatrist and the owner of Holistic Mental Health in Austin, Texas, had this wisdom to share.
I think this question reminds me of one of my favorite quotes by Mary Ann Rockmucker. And she says, "Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is that little voice at the end of the day that says, I'll try again tomorrow." And this is a challenging and very frustrating time for all of us. And so, like many parents, I try to be as patient and as loving, as possible with my son. I try to use my imagination and think about what life must be like for him and for other kids. Many kids, including my son, they really miss their grandparents. My son hasn't seen, his grandparents in 2 months. And he asks about them, and we try to have Zoom calls with them, but it's not the same as getting a big hug, from them. Kids miss their teachers and their friends and, being on sports teams. And then there's some families who are traveling to food banks, for the first time. And they're trying to reassure their kids that they have everything under control while wondering how they're going to make it to the next month without a job. So I encourage families to try and keep each other safe, to keep the lines of communication open, and to instill hope in their kids. And I try to talk with them about reminding them of the things that may be going well, even if it doesn't seem like a whole lot. But most of all, I try to encourage, humbly encourage, because I find that it's difficult to do this myself sometimes, is self-care, so that we can be emotionally available to our families. Because I find that if we're calm with ourselves and we're treating ourselves with grace and with respect, we're more likely to extend that to our children. And then at the end of the day, we try again tomorrow.
That was from episode 98, COVID-19 and Children's Mental Health. If you'd like to hear more of this wonderful conversation, you'll have to check out the full episode. You can find a link in the show description for this episode, wherever you find it. And that does it for this episode. We're glad that you could join us. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share about our podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Especially thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Production assistance by Anna Harris and Veronica Rodriguez. And as always, thank you to the Hogg Foundation for the support. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. You can find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn. Thanks for joining us.